One I'd like to start with is this one about the Sufi conception of the hereafter and how it is that when we're aware that we have tortured ourselves in this domain, on the day of judgment, there can be anything such as a hell. One answer is that when the Quran tells us, read your book, Iqra Kitabak, Kafa bi nafsika al-yawma alayka hasiba, it's as if we are being told, your intellect now is sufficiently illuminated by the light of absolute values, no longer clouded by this world and your body, for you to realize what it is that you have done, both to yourself, dhalamtu nafsi, I have wronged my own soul, and what you have done to others. And all the sins that you have done will be before you in the form of the suffering that they have caused for yourself and for others. That vision of suffering will be a vision of the heart, and that vision will cause your heart to suffer with an intensity proportionate to the suffering that you have caused, according to the divine promise and threat. But the mercy and the rigor should be noted here very carefully. What is the justice of God? That you will be recompensed on a one-to-one ratio for your evil deeds. But you will be recompensed, rewarded, on a 10-to-1 ratio for your good deeds. The Sufis are the ones who extract from this these spiritual concomitants. The theologians like to talk about eternal hell, and there are Quranic verses that will give them justification for that perspective. Psychologically, it's necessary for those kinds of people to believe that hell goes on forever, failing which they will not be frightened of sin. But the Sufis are saying that there are other people who realize that when God threatens something, he is not bound to carry out his threat. But when he promises something, he will fulfill his promise. Because the non-fulfillment of a promise is a lie, but the non-fulfillment of a threat is not a lie. It's a threat that this is serious, that I will do this if you're not careful. When you tell your child, if you do that again, I will hit you so hard that you, whatever, you won't stop crying for an hour. Child does it. Are you bound to carry out that threat? Try someone else, some other strategy. But God is giving us strategies that are appropriate for our degree of receptivity to spiritual truth. There are some, as Ghazali says, who need to be whipped into paradise. And one of our friends famously said, I'd rather be led there by a carrot. So the Sufis emphasize that hell is not eternal. And Dr. Lings has given a lecture on that very subject in Lahore University of Management Sciences the year before he died, stressing that point. That, and in fact, in the Surah Hud, you have a proof text, if you like, that says the wretched, those who are in hell, reside therein, ma damat as-samawati wal ard illa ma sha'a rabbuk. The people reside in hell for as long as the heavens and the earth endure. In other words, a limitation. And then a second limitation, illa ma sha'a rabbuk, unless your Lord wills. So there are two limitations on hell there. Whereas for the people in paradise, they stay in paradise for as long as the heavens and the earth endure. But then it says, عَطَاءٌ غَيْرَ مَجْدُورٌ, a gift never to be cut off. So when paradise comes to an end, because only God abides eternally, the gift of paradise comes to an end. So going back to this question about death, the death of paradise is only for the sake of an even greater life in the soul beatitude of the divine reality. Ridwanu min Allah Akbar. The beatitude, the good contentment, the pleasure of God is greater than paradise. So death or the end of paradise is only for the sake of an even more absolute plenitude of beatitude. So going to the lady's question about psychology and Jung, one of the most instructive things that Jung ever said, again I quote Dr. Lins, who said that Jung's most intelligent comment was to say that psychology has for its object, the soul, unfortunately, it is also its subject. And what Jung meant by that was a rare moment of objectivity on his part, that we psychologists, we psychoanalysts, whatever one they want to call themselves, we have no means of knowing whether we are objectively accurate in our estimations of this human soul, because it's the soul that has to examine the soul. We cannot have any objective means of analyzing ourselves outside of the divine spirit implicitly. But he never took that step, unfortunately. What he did, and what you've referred to, and one of the most helpful images of the phoenix and this mythology of the rising from the ashes, it's a beautiful symbolic expression of all of these principles, because everything that I've been talking about in relation to the Quran, all of these principles, stories, are rooted in a symbolism that is there from the beginning of time. When the Quran tells us that God revealed words to Adam after his fall, and then says, whoever follows my guidance, he will be rightly guided hereafter. It means that primordial religious forms were mythic, symbolic, and they did not have elaborate rules and regulations. They were symbols that elicited and awakened the human being's own innate knowledge, which is another reason why the Quran refers to itself as a dhikra, a reminder. It doesn't teach you anything that you don't know. Rumi says about the prophets, why do we believe in the message of the prophets? Because when they come to us, we recognize that we once were like them. They awaken in us a memory that we were once like that, pure, limpid water from paradise. But now we become muddied by our descent. This is in the book called Kitab Fihi Ma Fihi, the Discourses. So he says the prophets do not implant anything new in our substance with revelation. They merely remind us of what we once were and what we can become once again, if we follow the path of religious guidance, of revelation. Now this is where Jung, unfortunately, with all his wonderful knowledge of his archetypes, they are all situated between the conscious mind and this thing he calls the collective unconscious, this chaotic sea from which images and myths arise throughout human history and to which we have access in our dreams. And those archetypes are subconscious, in between the conscious mind and the unconscious. Whereas the reality is the opposite, that our conscious minds are like the distant reflections of archetypes, with all these myths and symbols that you've spoken about, but those archetypes are themselves expressive of the names and qualities of God, which are innumerable, not just the 99 theological names. And therefore you're making an ascent from the level of the human to the divine when you go to the archetypal plane, to which, yes, you have access in dreams, because in dreams, as the prophet said, 1/46th part of prophecy. So you enter into what Ibn Arabi calls the khayal al-munfasid. This is what's wrong, in my opinion, with the whole domain of psychoanalysis and dream analysis and so on, in Jungian terms, that what the distinction made by Ibn Arabi between the khayal, the imagination, that is munfasil, and the khayal that is muttasil, there's no way that a poor Jung or a Freud can understand. The distinction between the imagination that is tied to the individual soul, and therefore a prolongation of eminently individualistic imagination, and the imagination that is munfasil, that is separate, that is independent of, that really flies out of the cage of the soul and makes contact with the real world, the alam al-khayal, which is between this world and the world of the divine names and qualities. And that real world, which is more real than this one is a reflection of all of those things. You make real contact with it in true dreams. How does Ibn Arabi know to make this distinction? How does he know that he has objectivity sufficient to discern what is a subjective dream, purely subjective imagination, and objective, divinely inspired imagination that makes contact with this real world, Hurqalya, as it's called in the Persian Sufi tradition. He has access to that objectivity precisely through the degree to which his subjectivity has been effaced. He has died to himself, his ashes have been reborn as a new creation, in the light of which he can see all of the pretensions, the ru'unat of the nafs. And one of the worst pretensions of the soul is that it doesn't think it needs God or religion to understand the higher realities. A Jung, precisely. Look at the dream that he had. You know how important his father was for his dream world. His father appeared to him again and again and again. His father was a far wiser man than Jung. And in his dreams, the poor spirit of Jung was trying to tell him, do what your father did and learn from him and don't try the stupid path that you're on. In this, just look at this one dream. It's so famous, it's cited in all the places. I can't remember in what volume of his dreams and so on it comes, but it's so famous, it's everywhere. Where he's with his father in a house, and the house has a wonderful room with all these artifacts. I think it's Egyptian and so on. In the middle of the room, there's a staircase that goes up. And at the top of the staircase is a door, and it kind of disappears into no space. So he's aware that there is an ascension going on here, a possibility of climbing. And beyond that door, we enter into a different domain. It's not spatial anymore. And he's following his father, and his father says, do this. Prostrate, like I do. He went down and he did what we would call a sajda in Islam, the full prostration. You put your head to the ground in total submission to God. And Jung, he says, I saw my father doing it and I went down and I tried, but I could not get my forehead to the ground. I couldn't do it.
Pardon?
Well, it's a shame. You see, these are things. It's a shame. Just look at our, as Hans Yusuf says, I'm not making this stuff up. All right. I think we've given quite enough time for that. In fact, I think we had enough time for everything. Thank you all very much.